Welcome to JourneyWithJesus.net, a weekly webzine for the global church. I'm Daniel B. Clendenin. My essay this week is called A Beautiful Lie or an Eyewitness Account, The Transfiguration of Jesus. It's based upon the lectionary reading for Sunday, February 22nd, 2009. In the Gospel this week, we read about the transfiguration, or in Greek, metamorphosis, of Jesus. It's a story so central that all three synoptic writers include it. Listen to the text. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. Some readers will dismiss this story out of hand as a bizarre fiction. Others will purge it of perceived offensive elements while trying to retain some kernel of truth. For example, interpreting the incident as an embellished tale, as a truth communicated by myth or metaphor, or even as a misplaced and reinterpreted account of the resurrection. But I like the advice of Harvey Cox of Harvard, who cautioned against encountering the sweeping vision of Christian eschatology only to whittle it down to something manageable and lackluster. Many years later, Peter remembered this terrifying experience precisely to counter ridicule that the early believers followed, quote, cleverly invented stories, end quote, as opposed to eyewitness accounts of actual events. 2 Peter 1:16 to 18. The details of the story, exactly 6 days after Peter's confession that Jesus is the Christ, the identification of Mount Hermon in present-day Syria, which reaches 9,000 feet, the secluded and private nature of the incident, the palpable terror they experienced, Peter's impulsive outburst, and their confusion about something so essential as the resurrection from the dead. All these suggest that Mark was writing history and not myth or metaphor, even if the story, like so many stories in the Gospel, and by the way, like much of science, is easier to describe than to explain. Even if the nature of the transfiguration is not obvious, Mark seems to report a genuine experience. Sometimes even the recipient of such an experience is hard-pressed to explain exactly what happened. Luke, for example, records how in Peter's miraculous escape from prison, he had, quote, no idea that what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought it was a vision. Acts 12:9. Whether Peter, James, and John had an ecstatic vision, or whether Jesus was literally, if briefly, metamorphosized before their eyes, the natural physical phenomenon of brilliant light is really secondary to the supernatural metaphysical affirmation of the voice from the cloud. That this Jesus, whom the disciples followed, was not just a rebel rabbi, clever sage, socio-political provocateur, subversive wisdom teacher, an ascetic, or a failed apocalyptic troublemaker. No, the Transfiguration portrays Jesus as the cosmic Lord of all human history, in God's beloved and specifically appointed Son. Having thus experienced a fleeting glimpse and foretaste of the full and final consummation of all things, the gospel conclusion is inevitable. Listen to him. Three marvels accompanied the transfiguration. First, Jesus' clothes radiated blinding light. Matthew's version likens this radiance to the brilliance of the sun. Both descriptions evoke comparisons to Moses on Mount Sinai, when God appeared to him in a cloud and consuming fire, Exodus 24. Similarly, Paul described his famous conversion on the road to Damascus as an encounter with blinding light, accompanied by a voice from heaven, Acts 22, verse 6, and chapter 26, verse 13. It's a testimony that lends an experiential aspect to Paul's declaration in 1 Timothy 6:16 that God dwells in unapproachable light. Secondly, Moses and Elijah appear. In his transcendent glory, Jesus fulfills the law of Moses and consummates the end of all things that Elijah was thought to predict, Mark 9:11. And third, the voice of God the Father from a cloud, reminiscent of that at his baptism, Mark 1:11, affirms what only a few pages earlier Peter had confessed, that Jesus is God's beloved and specially appointed Son who merits our total allegiance. Listen to him. Nothing is easier for Christians who have become over familiar with the gospel texts and traditions than to domesticate and diminish them, taming the ineffable, trivializing the indescribable, cutting and trimming to neuter God down to manageable size. In his book, What Jesus Meant, Gary Wills tries to recapture the radically subversive life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Wills writes, "Jesus intended to reveal the Father to us and to show that he's the only begotten Son of that Father. What he signifies is always more challenging than we expect, more outrageous, more egregious." Wills goes on to excoriate Thomas Jefferson's scissored-down Jesus, who was little more than a mild humanitarian moralizer. And likewise, the more recent Jesus Seminar scholars, which he derides as the new fundamentalism, who end up with a bland cardboard cutout. The transfiguration of Jesus belies the ways we dilute the stringent wine of the gospel. The blinding light and voices from the clouds challenge faith that is turned tepid, perfunctory, bored, and boring. In her book, Teaching a Stone to Talk, Annie Dillard thus asks, "Does anyone have the foggiest idea of what sort of power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, does no one believe a word of it?" The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It's madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church, We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may awake someday and take offense, or the waking God may draw us to where we can never return. I can understand how some people will read the Transfiguration story and, as Annie Dillard admits, quote, not believe a word of it, end quote. But God save us from the safe middle ground of domesticating deism. And now for further reflection. How do we whittle down accounts like the Transfiguration, and why? Consider the many ways we trivialize the gospel and domesticate God. Why do you think Jesus gave Peter, James, and John orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until he had risen from the dead? And finally, for further reflection, see the book by Donald McCullough, The Trivialization of God, The Dangerous Illusion of a Manageable Deity. For books this week, I review Stanley Hauerwas and Jean Vanier. The title, Living Gently in a World of Violence, The Prophetic Witness of Weakness, Downers Grove, University Press, 2008, 115 pages. For over a century, the historical critical study of Scripture has been preoccupied with the chasm separating what we can reliably know about the Jesus of history and the Christ of post-Easter faith. And here I apologize. I realize I've given a different book review. I've confused the title of the book and the review itself. The review, in fact, is Joseph Ratzinger's book, Jesus of Nazareth. Efforts have been made to identify layers of traditions, with contradictory results but widespread agnosticism about the historical Jesus. Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, believes that the historical critical method is an indispensable dimension of exegetical work. But he also insists that the method has its limits and is not, therefore, sufficient by itself. Despite the wide variation of texts in the Bible, he assumes a prior act of faith that believes in a single overall direction or overall unity of the Bible. I trust the Gospels, says Ratzinger. After his short methodological introduction, Pope Benedict offers a comprehensive survey of the life and teaching of Jesus. Jesus was not just a rebel rabbi or an enlightened teacher of prudential morality. In one of the most interesting portions of his book, Ratzinger uses a friendly foil, the book by the acclaimed Jewish scholar Jacob Neusner called A Rabbi Talks with Jesus. Neusner gets it right, he thinks, even though he cannot commit himself in faith to Jesus, because he understands that Jesus substituted his very own self for all that Jewish history and theology holds dear. Jesus himself, in this view, is the new Torah, the new temple, the new Sabbath, or the new Israel. Benedict shows this to be the case as he works through chapters on the baptism and temptation of Jesus, his proclamation of the kingdom, the Sermon on the Mount, the Lord's Prayer, the disciples, the parables, the Johannine material, Peter's confession, and the Transfiguration. There are few surprises in this book by the leader of global Catholicism. Ratzinger aims to write in a personal and pastoral style, but sometimes he digresses into more scientific theological jargon, much of it about older German thinkers like Bultmann, Harnack, and Ulicher. This gives the book a distinctly Eurocentric feel. But the Pope says that the book is, quote, in no way an exercise of his magisterium, but solely an expression of my personal search for the face of the Lord. Everyone is free, then, to contradict me, end quote. The title of the book, Jesus of Nazareth, the author, Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict. For film this week, I review Slumdog Millionaire from 2008. Jamal Malik is only one correct answer away from winning 20 million rupees on India's version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. He's a waif, a tea server from India's slums. So the show's producers think that he's cheated. As they nearly beat Jamal to death in the opening scenes of the movie, the film proceeds to repeatedly flash back to his early childhood in the random event seared in his memory that enabled him to answer the show's arcane questions. But Slumdog is not about how Jamal could answer the game show questions, but why he became a contestant in the first place. He's clearly not interested in the money itself. This remarkable film is many things: action thriller, human drama, social commentary on contemporary India, a story of human destiny, and, most enjoyable of all, a tender romance. Slumdog is far and away one of the best films of the year 2008. Slumdog Millionaire. And finally, with Ash Wednesday and Lent just around the corner, we've posted a poem by Walter Brueggemann. The title is called Marked by Ashes. Ruler of the night, guarantor of the day. This day, a gift from you. This day, like none other you have ever given or we have ever received. This Wednesday dazzles us with gift and newness and possibility. This Wednesday burdens us with the tasks of the day, for we are already halfway home, halfway back to committees and memos, halfway back to calls and appointments, halfway on to next Sunday, halfway back, half frazzled, half expectant, half turned toward you, half rather not. This Wednesday is a long way from Ash Wednesday, but all our Wednesdays are marked by ashes. We begin this day with that taste of ash in our mouth, of failed hope and broken promises, of forgotten children and frightened women. We ourselves are ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We can taste our mortality as we roll the ash around on our tongues. We are able to ponder our ashness with some confidence, only because our every Wednesday of ashes anticipates your Easter victory over that dry, flaky taste of death. On this Wednesday, we submit our ashen way to you, you Easter parade of newness. Before the sun sets, take our Wednesday and Easter us. Easter us to joy and energy and courage and freedom. Easter us that we may be fearless for your truth. Come here and Easter our Wednesday with mercy and justice and peace and generosity. We pray as we wait for the risen one who comes soon. Walter Brueggemann, Marked by Ashes. Thank you for joining us at journeywithjesus.net for Sunday, February 22nd, 2009. I'm Daniel B. Clendenin.